Hello.
Hello.
Ian, how are you?
Well, about the same as I was yesterday, but thanks for asking.
Well, that's good, because at least you're consistent.
That's everything to me at this age. You know, continuity is everything.
It has to be, man, because people need to get what they expect, you know? And Jethro Tull's coming back, so that's great to talk to you, Ian, man. I've been a fan a long time. It's so cool that you can still bring your band out and have the people you want to play with and present this stuff that's really brilliant.
Well, it's what I do. I think when I was a teenager, I gave up notions of becoming a painter and decided to give it a go to become a musician. And that was about the age of, 18, 19. And, you know, at that point, it was a big decision to enter into either of those rather improbable worlds, which, you know, could have led to financial embarrassment, starvation, a few other disadvantageous aspects of life that would have loomed large if I hadn't achieved some success. But, you know, if you're lucky enough to make a record and get a few gigs, you have to think, hey, you know, this is the job everybody would love to have. And happily, after some 51 years now, I still have my job. And who wouldn't want to do what I do?
Oh man, I'll tell you, if I could play the flute, I would play it just like you do. But I tell you what, you took the flute and put it into the mainstream of rock and roll, which I don't think it really was before you.
Well, no, in terms of making the flute a lead instrument in a rock band, that certainly was not something that had been really done. But in my case, having been a guitar player prior to that, I played the flute, but I was thinking guitar.
Oh.
And so I think I've often cited, you know, people say, well, who's your biggest influence as a flute player? And I say, well, Eric Clapton.
I don't have
influences who are other flautists. I think my influences are more likely to be guitar players or possibly composers, but not necessarily flute players. I don't really listen very much to the other flautists. I occasionally work with some, but not not in the sense of really, it's not an instrument I choose to listen to if I'm ever listening to music. I tend to prefer the softer, more gentle, soothing sound of chamber orchestras. Nervously on an airplane flight somewhere, I tend to listen to calm, relaxing classical music.
Right, that's cool. Well, look, Jethro Tull has such a varied catalog, man, and thick as a brick. I can remember being a teenager, Ian, and loving that, and it was different than everything else. And I felt smart because I thought I was getting it.
Well, perhaps you were,
yeah.
in the sense that, you know, there was it was a little bit of surreal and intentionally confusing material that would just make people smile, make them wonder, make them think about what it was about. I mean, it all made perfect sense to me in terms of you know, what the origins were behind those musical ideas and lyrical ideas. But, you know, it was genuinely, from the point of view of being a record producer and a writer, I was trying to do something that I thought maybe half the people would get it, half the people wouldn't. But that's rather more interesting than just being very straightforward so that everybody gets the message. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Foreigner, an 80s...
Oh, my God, I cannot believe you said that. I'm a huge fan of...
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, Foreigner, there is no mystery. You know, it is straight ahead. You get it. The lyrics, the music, it's all absolutely unambiguous. And that's very welcome. The same way as I would love listening to ZZ Top. It's straight ahead stuff. You don't have to stop and wonder too much about it. You just lose yourself in the music, the rhythm, the repetition of it, and I suppose lyrics that just have a lot of nice, fun, little, easy associations. But that's not what I do. When I sit down to write a song, I'm going to try and find a way to tackle perhaps bigger subjects or more complex subjects, and I'm well aware that it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I'd rather be doing what I'm doing than being a second or a third rate Billy Gibbons or Lou Gramm.
Ian Anderson celebrating 50 years of Jethro Tull, and that's going to be down at the MGM Grand at National Harbor. That theater and that awesome venue is really great. You're going to love it. It's brand new and it is just macked out. It's so good.
Good. Well, I'm looking forward to what usually is in those kind of venues, which, you know, if you'd asked me maybe 20 years ago about playing in essentially casinos, I would have turned away in horror.
Right.
Because my awareness of that was really more connected to Las Vegas. But things changed around quite a bit during the last 20 years. A lot of the, in other parts of the country, the tribal nations casinos, they came up with some great venues, lovely theatrical stages. And of course, even now in Atlantic City, you have the same, you know, approach being applied, that you build a really good venue. It can take anything from a Broadway show to a rock concert to a stand-up comic. It's really, the casinos have become, in a way, almost like the performing arts centers.
Yes.
And they are very good venues because they're so organized, professional, and as long as you can find your way in and out without having to go through the slot machines and the casino floor, there's usually a secret passage that folks like me get to use that involves going into the bowels of a building through the places where they do the laundry and they do room service, and you get to see briefly how hotels work. It's backstage at a hotel as well as backstage at a music venue.
Right, man. And the amenities are good that come with that, and they can treat you nice, and that's the good part of it.
But they certainly do, but yeah. Of course, we're usually not really there long enough to be benefiting or appreciative of that nice treatment, because we got a job to do, and usually it's a question of arriving, you know, grabbing something to eat, doing a sound check, doing a show, and getting out of there either for the band and crew the same night, or perhaps for me first thing the next morning. So we don't get much of a chance to sit back and enjoy those benefits that come, because of course they usually compliment they give a complimentary hotel room to everybody. I mean, one each, we don't have to share. So that makes it usually nice. They're usually nice, comfortable, clean places to be in.
You know what? You can stay fresh on this tour you have coming up, I think, because I think I have all the dates in front of me. And you're doing three or four at a time. And
that's right, yeah. I don't like being away from home for very long, because for me, much more enjoyable to go out and do a few shows, come back for a few nights, go off again for a few shows, come back for a few nights. And
right.
Although America being long-haul travel for all of us, it's, I would still rather just do a few shows and come home and then live to fight another day and pop back again a little later. So we have three short U.S. tours this year, and of course a whole bunch of similar short tours taking place throughout Europe and other parts of the world.
Cool.
But I get to spend on average two or three nights in my own bed each week as a rule.
Great.
So that's kind of nice.
Ian Anderson is with us. I stayed away from all the questions that you hate, and I know what they are. So
no, I don't hate any questions. I just always think that life is very short if you're a writer or a radio personality, and you've got to try and find some things to say. Then there's obviously those questions which we've been asked 100,000 times, and I have no problem in answering them yet again. It's not something I hate. I just think those answers are all on my website somewhere, so you can check it out there.
Well, I just like to have a conversation. I'm not a Q&A guy, you know. I think it's more fun. And I think the person that comes on gets a chance to give their story way better and tell what they came to tell.
Yeah, I think it's much nicer just to try and wing it, as long as you have some reasonable command of the English language and you have something to say.
Yeah.
Which does lead us on to the current state of your administration. And I'm a keen follower of Donald Trump. Whenever he's on the television, then I'm glued to it in awe, and it's always a bit of a
but
I was on vacation in the USA about 2 weeks ago for first time in my life. I think I've actually been on, you know, actually taken a vacation in the USA. I'm always there to work, but my wife and I went for a few days of sunshine in the Florida Keys, and so you know, it was a 24-hour day exposure to American politics, and it's you know, when you actually have a vacation there, and it's just the stuff of which the news is filled, and I find it very interesting. I'm choosing my words carefully here.
Oh, you're going to be within the range of the White House when you're here.
Yeah, well, when I was in the White House a few years back, it was the time of George Bush Jr., who... You know, sometimes, I suppose, with hindsight, probably a lot of Republicans, in fact, a lot of Americans would think, can we have George Bush again? You know, he wasn't a bad lad. I always found him, you know, kind of, I think his heart was in the right place. But his press secretary, Tony Snow, was a great friend of mine. And
Tony Snow. I remember him.
Yeah, Tony Snow's a great guy. He interviewed me for Fox Radio, I think, at some point, and we hit it off and became big buddies, and he was a flute player. And he got up and played with us a couple of times as a guest on stage, and he was a great guy and a huge loss when he finally succumbed to the recurrence of his colon cancer. And George Bush gave a very moving speech at Tony's funeral, which I only recently heard, or saw a transcript of, in which he mentioned Tony as being a fan of Jethro Tull.
Nice.
And I believe he George Bush had quite a good humor. I think he managed to introduce that in the way that he got a bit of a laugh out of Tony's kind of rock music and jazz kind of interest. So it was an upbeat and appropriate speech, which I'm sure his family were very grateful to have.
That's
the
awesome
U.S. president there to say some kind words. But Tony was a great guy. In fact, my money would be, and I said this to Tony before he died, I said, hang in there, Tony, and, you know, your turn, you know, should come, because he was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. I mean, an ideological Republican, but he was everybody's friend. Everybody had respect for him because he was a man of principle, but he could talk to people, he could compromise, he could find his way through the mess of politics, and he would have been a great American president, and probably these days just about the right age to have that mixture of gravitas and a huge amount of experience. So,
yeah.
Sadly, Tony never got to follow what I personally think was his true calling.
Well, I'm sure he treasured your friendship, man, because that's very cool. That's wild. You know, the world is small, and you never know who knows other people and who has connected together. It's great. Because, Ian, you probably know everyone, don't you? I mean, in England especially.
No, I'm actually a bit of a hermit. I mean, I have acquaintances in the world of music, but I don't really hang out with anybody in the world of music. I don't really hang out with anybody come to think of it. I mean, I'm, you know, family and a very few friends, but
yeah.
Most of the time, you know, my working relationship is with my musicians and crew, and they are like part of a family, really. So, you know, when you've got a bunch of guys plus your own family and a few friends, that's, you know, that's quite enough. I probably have 20 or 30 people that I'm close to in that sense, and so I don't really, you know, I've met a few people, and most of them, even those with fearful reputations, usually turn out to be, you know, pretty nice fellows, at least they are to me.
Yeah.
Although sometimes, you know, I hear terrible stories about some individuals, but they've always been very nice to me, whether they're musicians or movie stars or from the world of politics or whatever it might be. They usually turn out to be, you know, perhaps I just get to see their more gentlemanly side. But I've met quite a few folks, and for the most part, I am not usually disappointed in what I see of them anyway.
Everyone's breathing the same air, so everyone should treat people like love. You love it.
Well, that's what we would like to think. Yes, absolutely. And I have a fairly optimistic view about human nature and a fairly optimistic view about the essential kindness and goodness of people. But of course, everybody has their Monday mornings. Everybody has their bad hair day. And if you get in, you know, if you just happen to meet Bob Dylan or Van Morrison on the wrong day, which is probably at least 6 days a week, you're going to be deeply disappointed and traumatized probably by the experience. But you know, everybody, you know, gets through these moments. As I say, I've met some of the most fearsome, and those were the worst reputations around.
Yeah.
they've always been really polite and real pussycats with me, but maybe they're just maybe it's because I'm that way with them, or perhaps I have a reputation that's equally as bad. So we're probably expressing mutual relief in our brief encounter.
Well, you know what? I find the same thing that you're talking about. People that have a reputation come on, and they are, you know, one on one, it's all different. Ian, you have a commanding voice that anyone would stand up tall and listen. And
one of the things I suppose you do if you're a songwriter, you know, you have to learn to use language and use words and try to construct, even in your day-to-day speech, something that it passes for the dignified use of the English language, and not to waffle or get into the kind of slang expressions that seem to decorate so many people's speech. I like to try to talk. I'm not terribly successful at it, but I like to try and talk in the same way as I would write. I'm trying to think as I talk to make dramatic sense of what it is I'm trying to communicate, and that's probably something that, you know, you get better at as you get older. Probably wasn't very good at it when I was in my teens or 20s, but it's got easier.
My goodness, you sound so good. And I
know,
just...
and the sad thing was there were several ums and ahs during the last couple of minutes, but I apologize for those.
That's okay. I can get rid of those. I get rid of that.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, the old the equivalent of the razor blade that we used to have in the days of tape recording. These days it's just an easy little snip when you're working in the world of digital technology, and I know, because I was doing that just a couple of days ago on a track that required a little bit of snipping, and I'm reminded how much easier and cleaner it is in digital recording to be able to do that.
I can take little snips and hairs out of this, and you know, it's Adobe Audition and Pro Tools, and you know what that's done. It's taken things to a different level technically, but analog and vinyl still sounds great, doesn't it?
Well, a lot of people have a huge nostalgic love for vinyl and the analog sound. I'm not really one of them, but I do pay a lot of attention to trying to get the best out of a vinyl cut, and it is truly the case that these days we do actually make much better vinyl records than we ever did back in the 60s or 70s. The technology is exactly the same. In fact, the machines that are used for creating the master lacquer from which everything is pressed, those machines are invariably old Neumann cutting lathes, which are 50 or more years old. Wow. And there are very few of them left now still in working order, and those that tend to be pirated for spares to keep a few of them going. And what has changed is that the technicians are real enthusiasts. The technicians really care. They really keep everything clean and tidy. And back in the days of Jethro Tull and Led Zeppelin albums being cut by George Peckham in a basement in somewhere in central London, you know, we'd all be smoking cigarettes. There'd be cigarette ash everywhere. It was a mess. But people didn't really care, and that's why a lot of records from back then do have a lot of clicks and pops and nasty little extraneous noises, which is a lot of it's to do with just dust and dirt in the air.
Yeah,
as well as the fact that George would always have a cigarette in his mouth while he was checking out the looking through the microscope to check all the grooves and the amplitude, and you see the cigarette ash falling onto the master lacquer. It was crazy. These days it's like a surgical operation. It's like being in a hospital theatre. Everybody's wearing very clean clothes, air conditioning. Nobody's allowed to smoke. Everybody is very conscious of the fact that you've got to make good vinyl records, and happily these days we do, and they do sound really surprisingly very close to the 24-bit digital masters. You can do it, but then you've got to play it back, and that depends on your equipment,
right?
So you can go to a lot of trouble to make a great sounding vinyl record, but how's it going to sound when you play that at home on your ancient gramophone that has a rusty old stylus?
Oh my goodness. Ian, thank you so much. You are a pleasure to talk to. I could talk to you for hours, and I can't wait to see you, man. It's March 11th. It's in the bottom of Maryland, right there at the Potomac River, where you can see the Washington Monument from the front yard there at the MGM. So we'll be down there, Ian.
Brilliant. Look forward to seeing you there. Take care.
Absolutely, man. Take care. You too.